Welcome to the Living Life on Purpose podcast with your host, Michael Mukunda Chandra Cohan, the founder of YourWellnessYogi.com and the Living Life on Purpose community. The Living Life on Purpose podcast is a show dedicated to inspiring people to achieve their goals and live their dreams to the highest potential. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose. Inside all of us is a powerful spark of the divine, and yet as life's challenges grind and wear us down, many of us forget that inner spark. However, that spark never leaves us, and if we stray too far from it, we will be unhappy in our life. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that inner spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our two free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle of Life quiz, a free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you a favor, to write us an honest review of our podcast. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/podcast and click on subscribe to open up in iTunes and write us a review. You can also write us a review on your device as you listen to the show by opening up the podcast app. Thank you and enjoy this week's episode, and I appreciate you listening. Hey everyone, thank you for listening to the Living Life on Purpose podcast. We have this week's guest is Pandit Das, who is a mindfulness leadership expert. He has spoken on mindfulness leadership and conducted workshops at places like Google, IBM, JP Morgan Chase, Harvard University, and Columbia University. At these workshops, Pandit presents the research on mindfulness and explains the importance of leading by example, appreciation, communicating mindfully, and managing one's emotions. He also engages the audience in various breathing and focusing exercises that individuals will be able to implement at work and at home. On today's podcast interview with Pandit, we interview mindfulness leadership, his life as a monk in New York City, and how mindfulness is great for managing stress. This is a great episode. I know you'll enjoy it. Hey, Pandit, thank you for being on the show. I'm really excited to have you here. Plus, I'm excited just to connect back to you and see what you're up to and how you're doing. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So before we get started, really quick, just let the audience know who you are and what you do.
Okay. So again, this is Pandit, and also known as sometimes known as the urban monk. And the reason that is there because I spent 15 years living as a monk in New York City. I'm no longer a monk after spending 15 years. About 3.5 years ago, I decided to transition myself out of the monastic lifestyle simply because I wanted to get married and have a family. And now I speak in corporations around the country on the topic of mindfulness, meditation, mindful leadership, stress management, work-life balance. While I was a monk, I was also doing a lot of lecturing on college campuses around the country, and specifically Columbia University and New York University on similar topics. But now I focus mainly on the corporate side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what was it like as a monk when you were living in New York City? Can you just go on with a little bit of a background of your monastic life, the tradition you come from, and your sort of daily, you know, lifestyle while you were a monk in one of the most heavily populated and most stressful places to live in New York City? That is New York City.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the perfect place, right, to be a monk. I mean, of course not. But somehow... you know, that wasn't part of my life plan, first of all, is to become a monk growing up in this country. You know, we came to this country in 1980, of course, why anybody comes to this country. We came here from India, And we came here basically for financial freedom, financial stability, to build a life for ourselves, to live the American dream, which is sort of what everyone's aspiring for, those who come to this country. So the first place we landed was LA. And, you know, my parents came with little to no money. Within a very short period of time, short meaning about an eight-year period, they became millionaires. They developed, they had a jewelry business, multi-million dollar jewelry business. But as soon as all that came, within about the same amount of time afterwards, we lost everything because our jewelry business caught on fire. Oh. And that's when things really began for me, where I started to introspect and ask myself the questions that I think a lot of people ask when they lose something valuable or when there's sort of a tragedy in their life. Like, why did this happen to me? What did I do to deserve this? So I was asking myself those questions as well. And to make a very, very long story short, we went to Bulgaria for a couple of years, post-communist Bulgaria in the early 1990s, which was nothing less than an adventure because nobody spoke English there. There was nothing on TV that I could understand because it was all in Bulgarian and in Russian. There was no facility to really play sports. There was no internet. So you can imagine everything that we do for entertainment, I could no longer do and couldn't even speak to people because people didn't speak English. So at that time, I sort of began my inner spiritual journey, studying the Bhagavad Gita a little bit. It's a primary spiritual text of India, doing some meditation, just trying to figure out what in the world has happened, where things are going. And eventually, after a couple of years, we moved back to the U.S., this time to the East Coast, and I moved into a monastery. After doing a few more types of businesses with my parents, I decided to go to a monastery in India, in Mumbai, India. Thought I'd spend maybe just a month there with monks, learning to meditate and just figuring out what my goal of life was going to be after having gone through a really sort of a crazy roller coaster of an experience. I loved that 1 month. I was living with monks and sleeping on a floor, living out of a suitcase, waking up at 4:30, meditating for hours a day, learning to do simple, humble things like cleaning and cooking and serving the community. And I fell in love with this lifestyle. To my own surprise, I didn't expect that to happen. And I ended up spending 6 months in India as opposed to the 1 month that I had gone there for originally. And after that, came back to the U.S. and moved into a monastery in New York City. And I thought I'd spend maybe a few months in New York. Ended up spending 15 years living as a monk in New York. And I was on the Lower East Side, which might be one of the busiest and craziest places in New York City. I mean, all of New York City can be kind of pretty crazy and intense and busy and hectic. But the Lower East Side has a special mood and flavor to it. You were asking me about what my life was like as a monk in New York, what my, day was like. I was waking up in the morning at 4:30 because our meditation time began at 5. That's kind of how the same schedule as the monasteries that I had visited in India. And, we'd be meditating, praying, doing sort of spiritual devotional activities in the morning for a good 4 hours. And then we'd help cook and clean. And then gradually I was just doing a lot of lecturing. I was lecturing on college campuses, talking about meditation, teaching vegetarian cooking classes, having spiritual discussions for students, helping students to think about other things in life other than just their material career. Because that's the only thing that's ever been talked to them since they were growing up, just make money, get ahead. But I want to make sure that we also talked about getting ahead in terms of your personal growth, getting ahead in terms of your own spiritual development, and not just getting ahead in terms of the monetary consideration. So it was very satisfying to be able to discuss with students. And it was such a fulfilling experience. I just wish that I had exposure to something like that when I was growing up. Somebody talking to me about, the real goal of life and to make sure that we're balanced both materially, emotionally, and spiritually.
Same.
I really wish there was somebody like that to guide me in that direction. Could have saved me so much just confusion and bewilderment. So that was sort of what I was doing a lot of was I was going to Columbia University a few days a week, cooking class, meditation, discussions, And then NYU, New York University. And then I started getting invitations to speak in other college campuses around the country as well. And so I would go to other college campuses and speak on similar topics. Sometimes professors of philosophy and religion would invite me to speak in their class on, you know, things from Eastern traditions like Hinduism. So that was sort of what I did. And it was a really, really satisfying experience. You know, I growing up, I never thought I'd be living my life in a way where I would be living it to serve others. Initially growing up, it was just like, okay, got to make money, got to be rich, just got to have a ton of stuff. But living in a monastery was eye-opener because I realized that there's so much satisfaction that can be found when you just live to serve others. You know, also just nourish your own physical and mental and spiritual and emotional life, and not just worry about purely the physical, because that's just such a small portion of our existence, because the mental and spiritual are such a deeper portion. So it was really nice to be able to focus on that and help others focus on that as well. So that's sort of what I was, you know, doing when I was in the monastery.
From your experience growing up and working with other people, why do you think that most of us, when we're young, believe that in order to be happy, we're going to get more stuff? That's what's going to bring us happiness.
Well, that's all that we see on TV. That's all we, you know, an average American spends several hours a day watching TV. And what does TV show? It shows movie stars who have fancy cars. They look great all the time. They look happy. They have got these houses that look like apartment buildings. They're like mansions. And every time you look at their, you know, they're on the news, they're smiling. And, you know, and it, you see movie stars or you see athletes like LeBron James or Kobe Bryant or any of your favorite like athletes. You know, they're driving around in the fanciest cars. When they come out, you know, onto the court, everyone is hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people are cheering. And so what's a young person, young adult in this country supposed to think, or anywhere in the world supposed to think, is going to bring them happiness? Because you emulate, you know, what you see. And we see supposedly that that happiness is coming from all of the glamour and the glitz and the glory and the fame, because that's all we see on television. But more and more, you can see the news of how many of a lot of these, you know, movie stars and, you know, famous singers and actors, you know, have drug problems and, you know, substance abuse problems and addictions and all of these other kinds of things. So unfortunately, really, really unfortunately, that's what the media communicates to us that happiness comes from. And it's so unfortunate because then we begin chasing that. Now with social media, it's even worse because it's like, you know, now we're trying to tell everybody how happy we are, you know, show everybody how happy we are through a picture. And I remember so many times when I used to, you know, be at Columbia, so many students would come to me, talk to me, tell me about their problems. And on Facebook, they look like the happiest person on the planet. But when I talked to them, I'd realize that, my gosh, there's so much misery in their life, so much difficulty. But we need to sort of give this impression that we're happy all the time. So we're not really being real with ourselves. We're not being real with others. And then all of this pretend happiness actually empties us out even more and more. We're ultimately, it leads us into depression because you can only fake it for so long until it eats away at you and just sort of like completely breaks you down. So really, it's very unfortunate that our media, our news, our the movies that we see, all of these things, you know, and every single ad on TV just makes you want to have stuff, you know. If you remember, like when I used to come home, I used to watch a lot of TV and watch cartoons, and every ad's about a toy or something like that. And it just shows these kids that they have the toy or this new gadget. They're so happy because they have this gadget. And, you know, you see something enough, even if you didn't want it initially, but you see something enough and enough people enjoying something, you're just going to want it. it just somehow will be like, you know, I guess I should have that. You know, I don't really need it. But, you know, but that many people are happy, I guess I should have it too. And marketers know that people need to see something, I think, 3 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be like, yeah, I want it. So they know that very well. They're going to play a commercial 20 times until, even if we don't need something, we're going to get it, spend our money on it, and then we're not going to be happy when we get it. But yeah, it's the ads. It's the portrayal and depiction of the rich and famous people that we want, that makes us believe that happiness comes from fame and money and power and things. And that is such, you know, unfortunately, that's such a lie. And even in school, we're not taught that. And I think that's almost like a betrayal. Like, you know, school is all about graduating and making money, which is good, which we need money. I need money. We all need money. But that's not all we need. That's just a small portion of what we need to really be happy. So, you know, I mean, so one good thing about, I think, social media, you know, since I did mention social media in a somewhat of a negative way. But one of the positive things about social media as well, there's a lot of positive messages being portrayed out there that are also going viral and encouraging people to look within themselves and, you know, spend time, quality time with each other. So there's good and bad of everything. But I think that's why, you know, we just grew up wanting things so that we can be happy, because that's what we have been sort of, that's what's been programmed into us by the media.
Well, that's where I came from. I mean, I was 29 going on 30, and, you know, I was living in New York City, living, quote unquote, the dream life. I had a beautiful brownstone apartment, first floor walk up with, you know, 13 foot ceilings overlooking the park. And I, you know, had enough money to go to every fancy restaurant I can possibly went to. And I was going on vacations out in the Hamptons and going down to the Caribbean. And I was traveling around, just having a grand old time. But inside, I felt empty, because I got to a point financially where I was like, this is it. Like, all I'm going to do is get more stuff. I'm 30 years old. This can't be what I'm supposed to do with the rest of my life. And the answer was always, well, find someone and get married and have a kid. And so I did that, and I met someone, and 6 months later, she walked out on me. And I was like, well, that can't lead to happiness, because, you know, obviously that didn't work out. So for me, it was, where can I find happiness? Where can I find true happiness? And that was the journey that led me to practicing yoga, which led me to the Bhakti Center, which led me to be in association with you, was that internal quest to find happiness that was more permanent in life and wasn't based on stuff or status or financial means, but rather on just having contentment for who I was and that connection to, you know, the God, the divine, what has many names. The other part of the conversation I did want to touch on to that we talked about is your level of success. Pivoting there is one of the things that I do notice in our field, especially as, you know, yoga teachers, life coaches, health coaches, spiritual guidance, we go on this journey to try to build businesses to become successful. And we think it's going to happen overnight. And we don't realize how long it takes to become successful. And you're one of those people that in our world, you're doing very well. And people don't realize how long it took for you to get to where you're at. And you touched on it as you were a monk in a monastery teaching at universities for over 15 years before you got into the corporate public speaking business. And so what I would like to ask you there is, what are some of the obstacles, or what are some of the things that you did to get you to the place that you're at now? And then where do you want to go from there?
Well, you know, I didn't follow any specific strategy to get to where I am. And, you know, have to honestly admit that there was definitely some good luck involved, some good karma, lots of blessings from, you know, from my teachers. I feel like made all of this happen. I don't feel like I had a specific strategy that I'm going to do this, 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 and this. It's going to lead to this. I didn't even expect things to get to where they are right now in terms of where I'm, the places that I'm speaking and the companies that I'm speaking to and the kinds of people that I'm speaking to. But I really feel that and everyone's journey story and everyone's belief is different, but I really feel like, you know, because the time that I spent in the monastery, there was a time when I was doing between, I'd say about 75 to 125 talks a year while in the, as a monastery.
As a monk, not making money.
Yeah, not making money. And it was purely to teach others. It was really purely just to serve others and help others become better. And they weren't all major talks. It could have been 5 people. It could have been 50 people, just whatever. I was doing that many presentations a year, 75 to 125. So did that for at least 10 years. And so I really feel like, you know, because I did dedicate a portion of my life to serving others, you know, I guess almost a quarter, actually about a third of my life actually, in that way, that I feel like, you know, the blessings sort of all of those people that I did serve in some capacity, the blessings of the divine God and my teachers, played a role in the success, the material success that I'm having right now. So, you know, I can't really sit back and just take credit for it. That, you know, of course, and I didn't realize at the time that I was in the monastery that there was no intention that, oh, you know, I should do public speaking because someday I can build a business. Because I moved into the monastery because life had sort of turned me upside down. The rug had been pulled out from under me. As I mentioned earlier, we'd lost our $1 million business and went broke. So I went into a monastery for a purpose of self-discovery and understanding myself, understanding the purpose of life. So I was just doing those things as a service because I realized at one point that to understand yourself, you have to serve others. So that's what I was just doing at the recommendation of my teachers. So I was just serving, and every lecture I gave, I saw it as a service to, you know, to others. And so I wasn't thinking that this was going to lead to a business. And actually, what a lot of people just really have a hard time believing is that I grew up absolutely terrified of public speaking, like absolutely terrified. I don't think you could find anybody more that would be more terrified of public speaking than me. I mean, I'm sure you can, but I was in that category. Never did it, never had to, avoided it literally like the plague. And to be doing that, I realized that this was, you know, some other sort of something else sort of controlling my destiny and fate. But I realized that, you know, I could somehow, every time I did it, people appreciated it. And I didn't realize that I was developing an incredibly valuable skill every time I went up there and spoke. Really all those 15 years were an incredible preparation. It was like my schooling, basically, in one sense, you know. It was like my college, if you want to call it that, my university, where I spent 15 years. But every lecture I gave, every time I spoke with somebody, I was learning. I was, you know, fine-tuning my skill of public speaking, presenting, also developing my skill and ability to, like, listen to people, hear what people are saying, because whenever I would speak, people want to come up to me, talk to me about whatever's happening in their life. So listening skills, speaking skills, you know, presentation skills, finding content that's relevant for people, presenting it in a way that's accessible, relevant, you know, comfortable for them. So it was definitely not an overnight thing. And again, when I was doing all of that service in the monastery, I wasn't thinking that this is going to lead to a business because I didn't plan to make money from that stuff. It was really for the purpose of serving.
So that's what led you to be an overnight success, the 15 years of practice and the 15 years of hard work that gave you an opportunity. And you know what they say, luck happens when hard work meets opportunity.
I wanted to take a quick break and remind you that it is never too late to make a choice and decide to make lasting changes in your life and create the life you want and learn to live life on purpose. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our 2 free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle Life Quiz, our free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for a real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life.
So then what your main thing is, you teach on mindfulness and you're a mindfulness leadership expert. And there's a lot of different definitions from mindfulness. A lot of people talk about what mindfulness is. It comes from different backgrounds. There's the Buddhist tradition. There's the academic tradition. There's the psychological tradition. And it's confusing for a lot of people what mindfulness is. Some people just think it's when you are just aware of your thoughts, and other people have different meanings. What is your definition of mindfulness?
So I have, I guess, different definitions. Some are shorter than others. Part of it is being aware of your thoughts and emotions, and being able to stay in the present moment. So that's a more of a shorter definition of mindfulness. Because so why is it important to be aware of your thoughts and emotions, right? So basically to understand, where's our mind at most of the time? You know, where is it at? What's it doing? Is it in a good space? And if it's, is my mind spending a good chunk of time thinking of negative things from the past, or the negative, or the regrets, or I wish this could have happened, or this should have happened, or why did it happen to this person? It should have happened to me. Are we spending just a ton of time in that space? Because if we are, then that's a pattern we need to change, because that pattern is just draining our physical and emotional and mental energy. It's not doing us any good. It's only harming us. So it's important to become aware of our thoughts and emotions. So what emotions am I going through? Am I always just upset? Am I depressed? Am I angry? So the more we can become aware of these things, the more we can, you know, train our mind to not go in those directions, right? Because the mind is, I like to think the mind is like a young puppy, you know, untrained puppy. So it's untrained, so therefore we can train it. But if we don't, a puppy is going to make a mess everywhere.
Right. Right?
Our mind's made a mess all over the place. So it's like a untrained puppy, but we can train it. So that's why it's important to become aware of our thoughts and emotions. We realize, oh, it's not in such good places. Well, I need to do something about it. And, you know, and then the bigger definition I feel like of mindfulness is, mindfulness is not just about meditation. Most people, as soon as they hear the word mindfulness or the term mindfulness, they think they imagine somebody sitting cross-legged meditating.
Yes.
So, you know, that's every poster of mindfulness will show some attractive guy or attractive girl sitting and meditating.
That's all it is. That's all you think it is.
That's all. Yeah. There's nothing else that comes to mind. So now the definition I have about mindfulness that I explain when I go into corporations, that it's not just about meditation. That's one important component of it. But it's also about how we deal with each other, how my words and actions impact the people that we're working with, the people that we're living with, right? How is it affecting them? Am I conscious of that? Am I able to change my behavior to make it a little bit nicer, more thoughtful, right? Really being able to look at oneself in the mirror and become aware of my tendencies and my habits, and seeing if we're able to actually, you know, change some of that for the better. You know, if it's in a workplace situation, you know, if I'm the boss, for example, am I just expecting everything from my workforce and not really appreciating them and caring for their personal needs? You know, am I just in it for them to, you know, to do the needful and that's it? Not caring for them as a human being, as a person. And also mindfulness for me is also, what am I putting into my body? You know, am I conscious of what I'm eating? And is what I'm eating, is that having a negative impact on the planet? You know, am I just using products that are polluting the environment? If so, can I make a change? Or am I so addicted to my way of living and my lifestyle, I'm not willing to change because it takes away from my comfort. Right? So what the products I'm using, the foods that I'm eating, right? Am I eating mindfully? You know, for example, as a monk, I was, and I still am, you know, a vegetarian. I eat only a vegetarian diet. And the idea is that, you know, vegetarian foods, first of all, It doesn't pollute the body. The body stays cleaner because its foods are lighter to digest. It's healthier for the body. Whereas, you know, many scientific studies show that non-vegetarian products, you know, can lead to like heart disease and cancer and things like that. So it's, I'm being conscious of the fuel that goes into my body. I'm eating mindfully. And also these vegetarian foods are less, create less greenhouse gases to produce. So that means my food choices are also affecting the planet, right? And so I feel like all of this is mindfulness, not just sitting and meditating, but it's how I eat, how I speak, you know, how I engage with others, how I work with others, how I live with others. You know, when I'm driving my car and somebody cuts me off, do I stick my hand out the window and give them the finger? Or do I have the self-control to say, you know, I'm not going to go there?
That's not my pet peeve. It's the person driving in the slow lane down the highway and you're in the passing lane going 50 miles an hour in a 75-mile speed zone and they're causing a traffic jam. And those are the people that frustrate me, not the person who cuts me off. Person who cuts me off, I'm usually like, oh, they must be in a hurry. It's the person that's selfishly driving in the slow lane because they're too lazy to like switch lanes when they need to.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's also, so we all have our frustrations, right? We all have our frustrations.
Yes.
And so the idea is to recognize that and to also try to find ways to not let that frustrate me. Like, for example, right? So when someone cuts you off, you have something where you tell yourself that maybe they're in a rush. Well, maybe we can also come up with a similar dialogue for the person in the fast lane who's going slow, who's being selfish, right? So maybe we can come up with these adjustments in our mind because ultimately the benefit is going to be experienced by me because I'm not frustrated, angry in that moment, you know?
Right.
So that's the thing, like, because we all have them. That also kind of irks me the wrong way, you know, where somebody just cuts in at the last moment. But I'm like, okay, you know, I've done it in the past. I'll let this person in and, you know, so really mindfulness, I feel like it's very broad. Mm-hmm. Just literally, how am I living and how the way I'm living, how is it impacting everybody around me and the other things around me?
And so would you say this is what is mindfulness leadership? Because I know that's the thing that you primarily focus on in the corporate world. Is that an part of mindfulness and leadership, or is that something more? The mindfulness and leadership is something more in depth in relationship to the workforce.
So mindful leadership is definitely more related to the workplace, and some of the ideas and the topics that I speak about when I speak to leaders or in corporations is talking about a few ideas. Like, for example, as a mindful leader, you have to be leading by example. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're asking your workforce to do something, you should be doing it as well. Because it doesn't look good if you're just telling everyone else to do something or behave in a certain way and you're not doing it yourself, and people think it's hypocrisy and they're going to lose respect and they're going to lose trust. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to be good for any kind of a workplace environment. Another thing is, as a leader, are you appreciating your workforce enough? It's easy to give the feedback when they don't do something right. Mm-hmm. But are we also taking out the time to, on a regular basis, appreciate people when they put in a little extra time or they did really exceptional work or they did something that you didn't expect them to do? And are we appreciating them? Because if we're not appreciating them enough and only giving the negative feedback, that's going to burn out that relationship. Any relationship that lacks appreciation is not going to last long.
Right.
Okay. And also, are we as a leader being able to communicate with compassion, or do we just sort of tell it like it is, don't have time to really have a sensitive conversation? So we just kind of shoot out the email, call somebody in, chew them out. We don't realize that. And that maybe just disturbed the person. Now they're going to be even less productive and less loyal and not really want to be in that environment. So you really hurt them and their ability to do their job. So being able to communicate with compassion, being able to manage your emotions. So these are the things, and I go into depth, of course, in all of these topics. These are some of the topics that I cover in my mindful leadership speeches and corporations. And of course, I close out with a short mindfulness meditation practice in which I teach them a variety of breathing and focusing exercises that they can use to reduce stress, manage their emotions, understand other people's perspective. And that's usually how I conclude my talk. And people find that such a nice relief to be able to do these exercises. And these exercises, of course, non-religious, non-spiritual. They're basically breathing and focusing exercise that anyone can do, even at work or before a company meeting, to sort of just get themselves in the right frame of mind, adjust their mindset, and get into it with a more clear mind and a more open mind. And of course, I do present a little bit of the research on mindfulness. In case there are people in the audience who may not be comfortable with the idea of mindfulness, who may be a little hesitant, reluctant. So I do produce and present some of the research that's out there so that those folks can also feel comfortable about the content and the practice that we're going to do.
Well, I do think one of the reasons why mindfulness is such a hot buzzword is because it's spiritual but not religious, but it's also material without being spiritual. It covers both sides of the spectrum. So you can practice mindfulness and be spiritual. You can be religious and practice mindfulness, or you can just be someone who wants to be a good leader in the workforce and practice mindfulness. And so there's room for everybody for mindfulness. There's nobody that can't practice mindfulness. And for the sake of our audience and the sake of the people here, what are some practical tips for someone to practice mindfulness that isn't necessarily spiritual or religious that they can bring into their workforce?
One of the things that I think we can do is, let's say that, before, you get to work, maybe you had some, difficult exchanges with a family member, or again, something happened on the road where somebody cut you off or was driving in the wrong lane and you're upset. Just even before entering the workplace, maybe just taking out a couple of minutes while you're in your car or however you get to work, just taking a few minutes to take a few deep breaths, and to acknowledge to yourself that I'm a little upset right now. Just to even be aware, because sometimes we get upset and we just walk right in to the next thing that we're going to do. And we don't realize that next people we're going to interact with are going to be affected by the baggage that I'm carrying. So just taking a moment before going in, like taking a few deep breaths, taking a minute, just take like 5-10 deep breaths. I'm like, okay, realizing that, okay, I'm a little upset by what my spouse or whoever said this morning. And let me just see if I can let go of some of that before I walk in and interact with my colleagues, because otherwise that's going to sort of spill out onto them in some way or another. So even the acknowledgement to ourselves that I'm feeling this way and taking a few deep breaths to let it out could be helpful. We can do that in the middle of the day as well. Just take a moment to sort of do a little body scan to realize, like, okay, my shoulders are really tense because I've been typing for the last 4 hours. So maybe I can just like go for a walk around the block. And what I tell people is, like, when you go for a lunch break, try to do your lunch break, if it's a 15-minute walk, without your phone.
Right.
Just, like the 15 minutes, the planet's probably not going to end. And if it was, there's not much you can do about it. Right. So just go for a walk for 15 minutes without your phone. And just, unless you're in New York City where there's no trees to look at, but most of us aren't. So just look at the trees, look at the sky, and just breathe and walk without having to look at your phone. And you'll see at that moment how addicted we were, like how badly we want to check our phone, and realize that it feels so good that you didn't have to do it. And then maybe that'll spill over into other aspects of our life. Like when we're having dinner with our family, we can leave our phones in the other room. Like, hey, get used to not having it. And right. That's okay. And also, like, or when you're going to sleep, put it on silent. Don't be eager to check your emails at 2 a.m. because most likely when you check your email, you start problem solving and then you've just lost your sleep and you're going to be more grumpy and less focused when you get to work. So these are some practical things that anyone and everyone can do and should try to do for their own well-being, and that aren't spiritual or religious.
Yeah. My life partner, her and I have a rule that we turn off all our phones if we're having dinner together. We're not allowed to have our phones at lunch. And 2 hours before bed, we turn off the Wi-Fi and we turn off our phones so we can't get access to technology. And this forces us to kind of be with each other, which is a good thing. But at the same time, it forces us to deal with whatever is inside that we haven't resolved for the day. And then we use certain exercises like writing in a 5-minute journal at the end of the day, or meditating first thing in the morning together, or reading the Bhagavad Gita first thing in the morning together, or doing our morning sadhana practice. And this way, when we do these things, we feel better. And when we're able to be more productive in our work and our professions, and then at the same time, what I've found through experience, when I'm constantly plugged into my cell phone, I am constantly plugged into, you know, not releasing my emotions and just taking time just to breathe, I begin to get cranky and I don't do that good at my job and things start to fall apart and then my relationships start to get stressful and then I begin to get negative. And then that negative, because that's one of the things that I majorly struggle with my whole life, is that negativity, I begin to judge people and I just judge everyone for no reason. And most people are really good and I'm just like negative speaking because I just have all this stuff inside me because I'm constantly bombarded once again with that message of you're not good enough, you're not worthy enough, you don't deserve this, everything, you need to have this house, this car in order to be happy and you don't have it, so you're just not a good person. And so that we've noted, we have those rules set into place so we don't get distracted and then we can be more present.
Those are awesome rules. Those are really, really fantastic. I'm inspired to hear that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm trying. Well, thank you. I'm trying to, you know, maintain, you know, being a yogi and a devotee and living in the middle of nowhere and honoring our tradition to the best of my ability. And yes, I should do a better job. I should chant more rounds. I should practice my I should meditate longer. I should be, you know, I should go drive into the city and go to the Bhakti Center. But I also at the same time have other responsibilities. So I'm trying to find that balance personally. And for me, mindfulness helps me find that.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
And so we're getting close to the end. Do you have a few more minutes for me? Are you rushing? I just want to get over one more topic that we had to discuss that I haven't gotten to. And it's my fault, but if we have to go, it's okay.
I could probably just literally do a couple more minutes.
I just want to do one quick thing. And what is, you know, since we talked about it a little bit, I want to ask you, what do you recommend people to do that have overbooked, overworked, overproductive lives that want to get into mindfulness? What are a couple things that they can do throughout the day? Simple actions or simple things they can do, or where can they learn these skills to become a little bit more peaceful in life?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is taking a pause in the middle of the day to, again, just really becoming aware. Like what I mentioned earlier, I'm going to go back to similar things that I mentioned earlier, is that being aware of your thoughts and emotions, like just taking a pause, you know, just like, what's going on? What's really bothering me right now? And does it really need to bother me as much as it's bothering me? You know, I'm worried about the future. Do I need to be as worried about the future as I am? Is my mind blowing things out of proportion? You know, am I making a mountain out of a molehill? So doing that will help us sort of just like release a lot of tension. Like, oh yeah, I'm worrying about this thing, which may not even happen because I'm worrying about something that may not happen. You know, I'm worrying about something that might happen 3 years from now, but we don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. So just sort of checking in with ourselves on a regular basis. And, you know, a couple times a day, just taking literally 5 minutes to do some meditation. And that meditation can involve just some deep breathing and exhaling, really deep breaths, and, you know, taking a moment to feel grateful for some things that's happening in your life, taking a moment to appreciate somebody in your life that's helped you and encouraged you or inspired you. Just simple things like this. And, you know, there's many ways that one can get started. One, of course, you know, I'm sure you just have to Google mindfulness videos or meditation videos, and you could probably find a bunch of stuff on YouTube. On my website, panditdasa.com, there's some meditations as well. There's a bunch of meditation apps out there that people can use to meditate. I don't really recommend one over the other because I personally don't use them. I just use my own meditation that I've learned in the monastery. So either YouTube videos, apps, my own website. There's a lot of resources people can use. There's even meditation studios popping up now in some cities like New York City and other places as well, where you can go in and meditate, like a yoga studio where you go and do yoga, or you can go in and meditate. So there are a variety of different options that people can explore to get started on this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Pundit, I appreciate your time. I think that was a great show, and I think a lot of people got a lot of knowledge. Any other final information that you want to give our audience before we jump off and you go do the things that you need to do with your day?
No, I think that's it. Just, you know, check in with yourself, check in with others, take time out to appreciate others, take time out to feel grateful for the things that are happening in your life. And that's a great way to change our mindset, shift our mindset so we can be more positive and happy. And if we're more positive and happy, that'll rub off on others.
Thank you, Pundit. I appreciate your time and I appreciate you. And thank you for being a source of light and goodness in this world.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for listening to the Living Life on Purpose podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes and write us a review. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Links to our sponsors and other tools can be found in our show notes, along with other useful information. For more information on our yoga and coaching classes, please visit our website at yourwellnessyogi.com and please sign up for our newsletter. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose.